you cool cats and kittens. All right, I'm sorry. I know everybody's doing some kind of Tiger King reference. This is Kel Weinhold from The Professor Is In. I am jumping on here to let you know that the episode that you're about to listen to was recorded prior to the COVID-19 outbreak and shelter in place for most of the world. So I just wanted to let you know, and especially around the productivity issue, to take it all with a grain of salt. I decided to go ahead and move forward with this episode because it is about a productivity pyramid, reminding you of all the different parts of yourself and your life that you need to put in balance to have productivity work. And the first one is your physical well-being. So listen to this episode through the lens of COVID-19, remembering that you are not working at home. You are confined and restricted to home and attempting to get some work done. So everything that moves forward is a success. Everything is a win right now. Any word on the page, anything done, every class taught, it's a huge accomplishment. So give yourself credit. And we're going to keep putting together episodes related directly to the situation that we're in, but we're going to get this one out to you right now. Thanks a lot. Hey everyone, I have a question. Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If you are, awesome, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have a ton of cool features like curated podcast lists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but our new members-only version of The Professor Is In podcast is only available on the Himalaya app. So be sure and download it, check it out, and keep an eye out for our members-only content.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to The Professor Is In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski.
And I'm Kel Weinhold.
And as always, we are very glad that you're here with us today.
Hey, I had an idea.
Yes?
I was listening to Pod Save America the other day with Brittany Packnett Cunningham and DeRay McKesson and Clint Smith III. And I was noticing that they always name their social media contacts, like their
handles.
Their handles. Mm. And I think that we should let people know where to reach us.
Oh, absolutely. Good idea.
And so I am on Twitter, Kel Weinhold, KelWeinhold.
And I am Professor Is In, all one word. So at Professor Is In. And also on Facebook, there is a very large and active community of about 71,000 followers at The Professor Is In. So be sure and find us there. That's usually the first place that I put up the new content on the blog and articles that I find interesting and my random outrage. I was going to say random musings, but it's not really so much musings as it is fury. Anyway, and then it goes there first and then usually goes to Twitter after that.
Oh, yeah. And with you saying that, there's also a blog and you can subscribe to that.
And the blog has fantastic content on it that is new content coming up just about every day, 5 days a week, with different post-academic transition content as well as core job market advice. I have a new video series, so if you want to see what I look like when I'm going off on my tangents and rants, then you can do that there. And Kel, you have a productivity.
I do.
Weekly
productivity post, which is what today's podcast is going to be about. Mm-hmm. This past month, I did a series of 4 blog posts about how to build your peak productivity pyramid based on the work of Tony Schwartz and Jim Lohr.
Yeah, those posts have gotten amazing feedback.
And they have. People have been really excited about them. And so we decided to talk about them today, understanding that some people come to information in different ways. And so they might want to read it. They might want to hear it. Just as a quick intro, Tony Schwartz is a executive productivity coach. And he, some years ago, started looking at work by Jim Lohr. And Jim Lohr has been a coach of elite athletes. And he was particularly fascinated by the idea that elite athletes, their training and the way that they operate is an oscillation between sort of high intensity, high stress, and then deep relaxation and dropping back down into recovery again. So there's a push and then there's a recovery. And he was really interested in how that could speak to or might be valuable to people who have to produce things at a high rate of speed, but mm-hmm. not all the time.
Mm-hmm. And so your insight was to apply that to the academic world and say, you know, so it's actually kind of third generation.
Right.
So you have the coaching for the elite athletes, which Tony Schwartz then took to the corporate executive coaching mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. and you read it. And then in the process, and that was years ago, and then in the process of developing your Unstuck program and productivity work with your clients, you suddenly remembered it and decided it might apply. Is that how that happened?
Well, yeah, well, you know, a lot of what happens with Unstuck is me helping academics rewire their approach to their work. They've wired in fairly negative patterns. Mm. And so I'm constantly asking them to find ways to detach or separate from their work and from the stories they're telling about it and just be. And it struck me that one of the things that Schwartz does all the way through this, and by the way, he and Jim Lohr have a thing called the Energy Project, because they make the argument that it's not time that we have to learn to manage, it's energy. We have to figure out how to manage our energy. So that's really where it struck me is, okay, this is a lot like what I'm trying to get academics to do mm-hmm. all the time, which is to pay attention to their energy, pay attention to where they're putting it, mm-hmm. pay attention. So mm-hmm. that's really how that all sort of came into.
Well, it's an interesting idea. It definitely shakes you out of your rut of I don't have time, or I have to make time, or I'm killing time, or using time, or, you know, which, by the way, is a super interesting linguistic digression that we could go on, but we won't, about all the ways that English metaphors work around the issue of time. And it's a tangible object that is very finite, and you cut it up into pieces, but you can also kill it and other things like that. But anyway, I love the idea of moving away from time to energy.
Right. And one of the things that first things we do in Unstuck, and for those of you who are listening and don't know what I'm talking about, I have a 12-week digital productivity course called Unstuck, The Art of Productivity. And it's a course that helps you build new writing habits and has been made a significant difference for a lot of the participants. But the whole thing that I have people do at the very beginning of that is I ask them to keep a time journal for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask them to set a timer that goes off every hour, and then they record what they did in the last hour.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main goals of that is to begin to notice when you work, when your energy is, and what are you devoting your time to?
Oh, right. Yeah, that's true. I remember that you do that, that it's like, when do you feel the best energy, and track that, and then make sure that the things you really are saying you want to get done, the things you're saying you want to prioritize, say you're writing, that you're inserting them into those energy periods, whether if for some people it's first thing in the morning, for some people it's midnight.
And how many people wait until they have the energy to do email? I mean, I think of a lot of times when I've said, oh, I can't, I'm exhausted right now, I'm going to wait until I have the energy to do that. So wait a minute, I finally have energy and I just used it to respond to administrative tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that got me on that. So basically what they argue is that they call it a peak performance pyramid, which is far too difficult to say repeatedly. But what I thought is, okay, how could we use that idea of oscillation to be able to create that regular bursts of writing and avoid burnout? They argue that there's a pyramid, and that the pyramid is made up of four components, and that basically to reach that peak performance level, we have to attend to those four levels of that pyramid, those four capacities. So,
and that one builds on the other.
And that one builds on the other. It's a pyramid, right?
Yeah, the foundation is the widest, and right, you can't get up to the second one until you have thoroughly established the foundational one.
Right.
Level.
And we love to, so just to give you the picture, the pyramid from the bottom is physical capacity, and then emotional capacity, and then mental or cognitive capacity. Cognitive capacity is what I called it in the blog post. And the final thing is spiritual capacity. So like Karen just said, you cannot leap, and academics, I know you love to do this. I know you do. You can't leap over the first two, land in cognitive, and stay there working at 110% effectively. It just doesn't work. And when I read it, I thought, of course it doesn't work. because what is the engine for all of this? What is the engine for everything we do? It's our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So the first level of the pyramid is a physical capacity, mm-hmm. meaning building or engaging with your physical self and taking care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he, Tony Schwartz, works a lot with very, very high powered executives who come up with endless reasons why they can't take the time to exercise.
Oh, interesting.
I don't have time. I have to get in the office. I have to do this. I have to do that. Then, of course, he shows everybody all the data and everything else of the people who are, you know, points to all the executives who have a regular workout plan.
Right. And they're like 17 times more productive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they have a regular food plan and they have a regular sleep plan.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing there is the regular part.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's ritual.
Mm-hmm. It is ritual. And you know what else? So I, of course, read your 4 blog posts with interest and really thought about them. And one of the terms that you used in every blog post that really struck me, and I do believe this is one of Schwartz's and Lehrer's, primary interventions is that you work out rituals for all of these things so as to reduce decision fatigue.
Yes.
And I had not really kind of engaged with that term before, decision fatigue. But as soon as the first time I read it, I said, oh my gosh, that encapsulates so much of my life because we have so many decisions we have to make at every single mm-hmm. minute of the day. And I mean, from what we eat, when we eat, and, you know, not to go all Karen, you know, apocalyptic.
But here I'm going to.
The decisions, I'm thinking of The Good Place, you know, for those of you who've watched it, there is no ethical choices under capitalism. But basically, these choices have all become so incredibly fraught mm-hmm. because we might want to have a tomato and then, you know, on our sandwich. And then they're like, oh my God, but tomatoes aren't in season. That means what's the carbon footprint of this tomato that I just put on my sandwich? I'm so stressed out. And, you know, so I feel like decision fatigue. Oh my God, I didn't bring my reusable fork. No, I just took a plastic fork. What do I do? Should I just eat with my hands instead?
Okay, we might be getting a little far afield here about what I'm talking about when I'm trying to reduce decision fatigue.
We are very far afield, but I just want to say that decision fatigue is a reality of our life.
Yes.
I feel very confident in saying to an historically unprecedented degree.
Yeah, I think that you can, I mean, now we can flip over and look at Brené Brown's research on the new trends toward scarcity, especially in the U.S. We are in a scarcity mode. And so we're always feeling like everything is pressed. Everything is not enough. Mm-hmm. Everything. So I think decision fatigue is in there.
Mm-hmm.
What struck me about that was that it put me in mind of another article that I read. And unfortunately, I couldn't possibly cite it. It was ages ago, but it was one of those, you know, 7 habits of extremely successful men or something. I don't remember what it was, but I'm sure it wasn't called that. But basically it was probably a BuzzFeed, like, these are the 10 things that the most successful people in America do. And of course, the 10
people. It's just
people
a coincidence that they all happen to be men.
Right?
Yeah.
Or all men. So one of the things that was so awe-inspiring to me about that article, this weird little thing wherever I read it, was that all of them, their mornings were ritualized completely.
Mm.
They used no cognitive energy whatsoever before they got to work.
Wow.
Up to and including Steve Jobs. Think about Steve Jobs.
Mm.
What did Steve Jobs wear all the time?
The black turtleneck. Yeah.
He didn't even make a decision about what to wear.
Mm-hmm.
He got up and did the same thing mm-hmm. every day, including, I'm going to wear my black t-shirt and whatever pants he wore. I don't know. But he took away all of those decisions. So by the time he got to work,
he wasn't fatigued. Mm.
So I put that article together with the Tony Schwartz article and thought, okay, listen, what if we could figure out for academics, for everybody, but we're talking to academics, what if we could figure out how to ritualize our mornings
mm-hmm.
to take away as much decision fatigue as possible. Mm-hmm. Do the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. So several years ago, I decided that I would lay out what was the perfect morning going to look for me. And mm-hmm. I wrote it in my phone notes. Mm-hmm. I don't stick to that every day, but when I don't, I notice that the day is more frazzled because I had to make too many decisions in mm-hmm. the morning. So if we can think about what if I get up and I do the same thing?
Mm-hmm. So what was yours?
Well, first of all, it's called Five to Thrive, which my niece came up with mm-hmm. and that I've shared with my coaching group. So a lot of people use it. So I get up. The first thing I do is meditate. Mm-hmm. The next thing I do is Morning Pages, which is a thing from Julie Cameron from The Artist's Way, where I write 3 pages longhand about whatever's in my head. There are no mm-hmm. rules for Morning Pages, but they are fantastic for clearing the decks. The next thing I do is exercise. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing I do is a real breakfast, like a good and planned breakfast. Mm-hmm. And then the fifth thing is a not doing, mm-hmm. which is I don't look at a screen until those are done.
Okay.
So
I like that.
So if I do that.
I like how you added that as a fifth thing, even though it's the absence of a thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I think you can make, I think habits can be the absence of a thing.
Yeah.
Right.
All of my life, I was always very much a sort of a loner kind of, self-motivated sort of person. And exercise was a thing that I did on my own, like walking or jogging or swimming or whatever. And about 5 years ago, I started doing a dance class. And now my entire life revolves, as you well know, because that is nothing gets in the way of my dance classes. And that has absolutely reduced decision making around exercise to almost nothing.
Right.
I mean, occasionally there's a decision as to, maybe should I add another dance class?
Right.
But that's the extent of it. Otherwise, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in the same place with the same people. And I love it.
And for those of you who are out there saying, I need to do exercise. I need to eat better. I need to sleep better. Shut up. I totally understand. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage you to make a list of what perfect would look like and then slowly move toward it. And don't expect it to stay perfect all the time. Don't expect to do it every day. But imagine what it would be, because you can't reach a goal if you don't state what it is. Really, most people don't reach goals accidentally. So, and then think about what would it look like to make that happen? And it may take you 2 years to get there, but you'll be moving toward it all the time. So don't think you have to go to dance class 4 days a week. You could just start with walking on Wednesdays at lunchtime with your friend in the department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I used to mention this on Facebook Live, but when I was swimming every day, I swam first thing in the morning, mm-hmm. and then I would get showered and dressed and go into work in the department, that there were times I was running so late that I could not do my regular 30 minutes. And I had a deal with myself that if I could do 17 minutes in the water, that was worth it for me. And there were many, many days that I only did 17 minutes of swimming. And the issue there was not like, I'm going to point to this great fitness goal that I just achieved in that 17 minutes. Probably wasn't much of a fitness goal, but what it was a mental
goal.
Exactly. Which is, I'm a person who swims every day. Mm-hmm. And that definition held.
Right. And it also, I do think that and this is what they talk about in the pyramid, right? So you start with this physical, and that means food, exercise, sleep. Right. So you start with that. You're going to have waxing and waning in your physical well-being, but you really want to just be aiming for that, right? So 17 minutes in the pool is better than 0 minutes in the pool. Mm-hmm. You still get to check it off. I went swimming.
Exactly.
As long as you go get into all or nothing thinking.
Right.
And I want to point out that the two really important things here about the physical well-being are, number one, that ritualizing it as much as you can, and then thinking about it as part of the oscillation between your work, mm-hmm. whatever that is, yeah. and relief from it, right? So start to see your walk with your friend as the downtime mm-hmm. from your peak performance of your cognitive mm-hmm. part.
So in other words, to understand that not just as yet another task that you did, which is I'm exercising, and all of the good that we know, comes from exercise, but it's also the absence of other stuff.
Right.
the absence of stress, the absence of this pedal to the metal productivity imperative that we are, the grind that we're operating under. So your mind is getting that release from it.
Right. So if I asked everybody out there right now, next week, set a timer on your computer and get up for 10 minutes every hour. I can almost feel like the energetic ripple across the land as you're hearing this. Like, I don't have time to get up and leave my computer for 10 minutes every hour. And I'm saying, you actually do, because that's the oscillation down from stress that's going to give you the energy to do the cognitive part, but also it's going to help you get that physical
That's true.
Capacity built up.
Right.
It's hard to get a physical capacity built when you're on your butt all day.
Yeah, for sure.
So next on the list.
Emotional capacity.
Right. So emotional capacity is, and I thought this one was amazing to write about because it reminded me yet again of how we get absorbed into the critical and the negative, right? So his basic thing is, look, this is energy management. What makes you have energy? Negative emotions or positive emotions,
right? What energizes you? I mean, that's with just energy as in the verb form, energize.
Right. So if I said to you, what energizes you? Reading the latest news about the imposter in the White House?
The collapse of democracy?
Or petting your bunnies?
Oh, you're actually asking me.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. We could dig into that because I know that the correct answer here is that petting my bunnies energizes me, but honestly, petting my bunnies relaxes me.
Right, but that's the point. That's the point. You're back to the oscillation again, right? If we can think of and then bring into our minds and in our bodies positive memories, positive thoughts, successes, fun things, put a picture up in front of your computer of the last fun thing you did and look at it now and again and bring that in.
That marvelous vacation you took in Hawaii and you were body surfing and someone got a picture of you or a picture of her daughter and she's just ecstatic. You know, she's only like 9 years old or 8 years old in the waves. And, you know, it's a picture of pure joy.
And even looking at that picture, so we can take that picture as an example. So she's 9 years old. She's a total water dog. She's out there in the surf, getting rolled around in the surf and laughing. Looking at that picture, what that does for you and your emotional capacity is to build the habit of feeling and embracing and using joy and positive thoughts as your engine, as your fuel. So they're making the argument to start to train your brain. And this is really, really resonated for me because it was so much like unstuck. Is how about if we spend some time thinking about how things might work instead of how they won't work? Let's think about what it'd feel like to be a success instead of what it feels like to fail.
Right. I feel a little bit like we might be conflating two things. One, which is the release and the relaxation and the joy that comes from sort of setting, you know, turning away. Like I turn away from my laptop, I turn toward the rabbits, I start petting them and talking to them. And I am now in a totally different space. And that is a very essential space to my well-being and my productivity. That's a little bit different than a kind of a discipline that I think they're talking about of actively recalling joy.
Yes.
And actively changing the way you think. Right. So I just want to make sure we're talking about one thing, or if we're talking about two things, to make sure we're clear about what
they are. No, I think we can have those be two things. I think that, you know, we can have things that evoke those things for us or that we go to them to have it. So I think for emotional capacity, yes, you can sit there at your desk under stress and say, I'm going to take 5 minutes and I'm just going to sit in the memory of my little sister's wedding. Whatever it is for you, just that moment where you're just like, I'm going to go here for a moment.
Right.
Because that energy into your body is going to make you more energetic. It's going to give you the juice to do another rise up in the oscillation. Mm-hmm. So as you start to sink in energy, looking at those capacities, do you need to move? Do you need to get better thoughts in your head or more supportive thoughts,
right?
There are thoughts that support you and there are thoughts that get in your way. Or do you need to go pet your pet?
Mm-hmm. I want us to also think about what you often talk about in Unstuck is changing the words and the word order that you use when you talk to yourself and about yourself and about your work. So I'll never get this done.
Right.
I will get this done.
Right.
I'm working on my book. I'm working on the first part of chapter two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on this paragraph of my book. So this is all related, right? Would this fall into the emotional?
Yeah, I think the thing that's interesting about it, if you look at it, is pretty soon they all start to weave together. It's not like we're all walking around with a stacked pyramid in our bodies, in our brain saying, well, this is the physical and now that's finished and here's the emotional.
But I want the pyramid.
I know you do. You want a clear line.
I want a clear line.
You'll notice in the one that they use, the pyramid is all one color.
It is?
Yes, they don't separate it out into
different
colors. Oh my
gosh, that would drive me crazy.
Trying to show you that they're all one on top of the other, not separate entities. But I do think that that's a really interesting question always to say, okay, is my changing my wording around something? Is that building my emotional capacity? Yeah.
Well, I mean, we might be jumping ahead to cognitive, honestly, with that. And that'd be fine.
Yeah, except the cognitive is really clearly stepping away from thinking.
Oh, really?
So the cognitive capacity is not changing your thoughts the way that they're writing about it. They're not saying, let's wire in new thoughts.
Okay.
That's actually what they're saying is, step away. Stop thinking.
Oh.
Stop thinking.
Oh, okay. So then actually, not to be overly nitpicky, but of course I am, the stepping away to pet the bunnies and have that downtime is actually more in line with the cognitive then.
Yeah, that's actually. I would argue that it's blending both because it brings you a positive feeling. Mm-hmm. If you were just stepping away to just say, okay, now I'm going to pet the bunnies in there, now I'm not thinking, and then you went back, but you actually got an emotional juice from that.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. And we all have those things. Think about those. I think that's one of the things that I think is so sad about the Academy is that the joy juice gets lost, right? You're so busy critiquing everything.
Critique everything. One of the most dramatic transformations for me of leaving the Academy and starting this whole post-academic life was that I began to enjoy things again.
Right.
I enjoyed movies. I enjoyed TV shows. I enjoyed books. I read for pleasure. And I did not always have to be searching. My mind didn't always have to be on high alert, searching for the flaw in everything.
Right. And I think that what happens, and it happens in graduate school where you have that sense that you should be doing something else. And I had a client say the other day, I had posted the article about the physical capacity, and the person said, I can't figure out how to fit this in because I feel so guilty when I'm not at my computer. And I said, the question is, who are you? Guilt implies that you're failing someone and that you've done something, you know, out of alignment with what you've agreed to. So who is the person that you're feeling guilty about? And is that person actually on your side? So I think that as we think about these things, the stepping away, the physical stuff, there's going to be this push to not do it because we have to stay right there because of that. There is no joy in Mudville. There's only work. You can't do joy and be a serious academic.
Right. And they shame you. They shame you for joy. If you are kind of naively delighted with anything, God forbid, you know, someone's going to smack you down. I lived this. I did this. And I still experience it with our academic friends. I remember telling one of my academic friends, she's still a professor, an interesting article I read that was actually fairly brainy and analytical even so. But I said, I really like this. I found this really insightful. And she responded, well, isn't it rather utilitarian? Isn't it rather utilitarian? So I said, oh, you say that like that's a bad thing. But I was so aggravated.
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, not to indulge in anti-intellectualism and the fact that we, can continue to critique things that deserve to be critiqued, and B, what I know to be the case for myself and so many is that we find tremendous joy and relaxation in the act of critiquing. Like, I know that.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not exhausting and alienating to us. It's actually a way that we engage with. It's this form of intimacy amongst academics. So, I mean, you know, there's a gray area here. I mean, it's not black and white. And but I think our listeners are probably going to have a pretty good internal sense in terms of what we're talking about when it's, you know, brutal, the grind, the work, where your brain is just, you know, struggling and against this imperative work, 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 and then the kind of relax, whatever the relaxation is, where you turn that off. Let me give another example. As you know, and I've mentioned on this podcast before, I'm currently obsessed with the British Dark Ages. And when I turn my brain off, my stress brain off, the thing that I turn to relax my brain is I open up a bunch of historical works about the British Dark Ages and the collapse of the Roman Empire and the withdrawal of Roman forces from Britain and, you know, the Jutes and the Angles and the Saxons and who did what to whom and what kings there were. And this actually relaxes me. And part of the reason it relaxes me is because I'm not a scholar of that time period. I'm not a historian of that time period. And I don't have to care whether anyone is accurate or not.
That's actually right. You don't have to. You can't critique it because you don't know enough to critique right. it. But it's high level enough to keep you entertained.
Yeah.
But to me, the thing to pay attention to in the joy category is, did you used to have hobbies? Do you know what they are? How long has it been since you've done them?
Mm-hmm.
If I asked you to sit down and write down 10 things that you enjoy doing, 10 things that you enjoy doing.
What a great exercise for academics.
And then right next to it, how long has it been since you've done it?
Mm-hmm. Boy, 10 is a big number for academics.
I know. Read my material, write my material.
Think about my material.
Think about my material.
Talk to other people about my material.
Do you remember before you went to graduate school? Remember you used to knit? Remember you used to hike with friends? Remember you used to read, you know, bad romance novels? I don't care what it is.
Right.
It's getting
and the fear of admitting it.
Right.
Some of it is considered so déclassé. So like knitting has had a resurgence. Now it's okay to say you knit, but to say you read bad romance novels, banish the thought.
Right. Especially right now with all the
romance writers.
Anyway. Which I've only vaguely followed on Twitter, but I know there's a thing.
There's a thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So, racism.
Yes.
White people.
Yes. I should have said, I know there's a racism thing. I know that white people are at it again. We ruin everything.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay. Last one. Spiritual level.
The thing I want to do before I go to spiritual level, I really want to go back. I really want to say that those first three categories are critical, that you approach them in a particular way and that you understand that the power of them is in ritual. So physical capacity, emotional capacity, cognitive capacity, because we got it sidetracked and we didn't talk about the important part of cognitive capacity is taking time away. And I used the example when I did the blog post of how many people have had a good idea while staring stressed out at a computer and how many people have had a good idea while taking a shower
exactly.
or driving across town or wandering through the grocery store.
Or taking a walk.
Right. So that downtime, that oscillation, so those three things, it's critical to understand that they are not only that you're practicing them, but you're practicing them, ritualizing as much as you can. And oscillating, that you're saying, I'm going to do this and back off. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use one to do the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
For academics, there's a ton of work that goes on in the cognitive. So really using the physical as the oscillation.
Right.
So you're ritualizing and you're thinking of working all the time is push, relax, not I'm going to drive myself to the very edges of my ability to cope and then I'm going to collapse.
Or to do that other thing that academics are so prone to do is like, fine, then if I have to do a physical thing, then I'm going to train for a marathon
right.
and not just one, but seven. Like this guy I saw on social media yesterday, who, you know, white guy had to run seven marathons on seven continents in 81 days. And I was just like, shut up. Anyway, I just got so aggravated.
In fact, we need to do a podcast on that. We need to do a podcast on what I have in a webinar that I did called Stinking Thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's based on an article on Stinking Thinking. It's 10 ways that you get yourself into a bad place. And one of them is that all or nothing, right?
Mm,
it's like, well, I'm going to go exercise. I'm going to do seven marathons. Okay, how about we just walk? Right. Just for 5 minutes, just walk around your office. Right. Let's just start tiny.
Right. Just walk out the door of your building and walk around the building and then walk back in.
Everything does not have to be competing to be the A++ student. It can just be the person who just wanders around. Anyway, so those three things. Mm. Those three things, you want to think about them as ritualizing whatever you can. I work out at this time. I always do this to relax. I step away every 10 minutes from my computer. I use these as the way to shut my brain off, whatever those are. And the last one, spiritual capacity, is the one I said in the blog post that, you know, people freak out if you hear the word spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. They start running. Mm-hmm. Except all the religious scholars, and they're like, oh, I can handle that.
Right. The big shock of going to the AAR meetings was everybody's actually talking about religion.
I know they're talking about religion and their religious practice. It was like, what are you talking about?
It was very weird. But anyway, yes. In general, academics find religion, they get hives. Spirituality. And that kind of talk. But as you point out in your blog post, what these guys mean for this in this context is being aware of your values. Yes. And what are your values, and then whether you are manifesting those values in what you're choosing to do,
in how you're working,
and how you're spending your energy.
Right, and how you're spending your energy. So if I came to you and said, "List your values for me," and you said, "Well, my values are compassion, accountability, and community. Those are the things that I have prioritized." Hmm. And then if I said, okay, now let's look at your workday. Where are those? Mm-hmm. I don't know, because I don't know what your values are or what your workday looks like. But this is where you really have to start looking and saying, okay, I'm going to start looking and seeing at, like, enumerating, what are my values?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to ask, even quietly of yourself.
It is.
And certainly not one that we are asked to ask in the course of the cult indoctrination that is graduate school.
Right. I think that's just a really, really challenging question for a lot of people. Mm. And if you and I were in one of our talks with a bunch of academics and I said, write down your three core values, be like,
Well, first of all, define value.
Yeah. What do you mean by
define
values?
Core?
Right.
And what do you mean by right? Anyway.
Yeah, we'd have to discuss what the meaning of core and value
is. Exactly.
So, what they recommend is some kind of practice that puts you in touch with those. And that can be everything from morning pages, which is one of the reasons that I have people do them. Every morning, writing out whatever is in your head gets you closer and closer to what's going on in your head.
Behind the scenes.
And behind the scenes and with you, and closer and closer to what you want to do, because it all starts to bubble up. Mm-hmm. But I think there are other, I mean, there's, that's what meditation does, right? Mm-hmm. It's what service work does in a lot of ways. You know, I think about, if your value is that, you know, community and service, if you take the time every day to go do service for someone, to do work in support of something, you get really clear on your values really quickly, because you're using your time very specifically and you want to make sure it matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Volunteer work.
Right. So I think that there's
supporting political causes, showing up in the streets at a, you know, rally or something.
Right.
All of those are different.
There are different ways that your values are manifested. I think that what they're saying is the way that you build capacity in that is to begin to sit and look at them, mm-hmm. find a practice that puts you in touch with them so you can then identify them. Mm-hmm. So then you can start to apply them, but you have to identify them first.
They could be applied, you know, more directly in your academic productivity as well. But, you know, I actually want to throw up a classic professor's in caution here. Because one of the things that happens quite a bit in my talks around the country about the academic job market and the academic career is that after I describe how rigid, how judgmental, how unyielding and careerist and competitive the academic career and status-driven the academic career actually is, and individualistic, someone will always raise their hand, and it will be a woman, and she will say, well, from a feminist perspective, I don't agree with any of that, and I don't like it, and I want to change it, and I want it to be different, and so please now tell us how to make it different. Right. And I don't love that question, because usually it's a grad student. I completely love the idea that we don't like these values and that we want to have different values. But I don't like the idea that there are people who are so focused on creating different values that they are actually resisting or disregarding the realities of how academia is in fact constructed and what it rewards. And a classic example would be, say, co-authoring instead of sole authoring in areas, and if you're in a humanities field where these are like optional to you. And it's like, well, I believe in collaborative work, so I'm only ever going to co-author. That is a great choice you absolutely can make. And your publications that result from that will absolutely not be as highly valued on your CV. So, and I'm bringing this up not to dispute anything that we're talking about today, but just to make sure that, you know, sometimes there's a real politics and a power issue around values and when you choose to manifest them and how you choose to manifest them as you make career-related choices. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Though, I guess I would, if I were in the room for that, I might tweak that a little bit in that, great, you know, I believe in collaborative work. It's great. Then be collaborative. Do all of the things that collaboration, that builds collaboration. And you have to have some sole authored articles. So this baby bathwater thing of like, well, I believe in collaboration, so I'm only going to do this kind of work. You could make the argument, if you wanted to get really picky about it, that that's not collaborative. To say I'm only going to do something one way is against the very definition of collaborative. So you could say, okay, I'm going to work with the system. I'm going to deal with the system the way it is, and I'm going to start to do these changes. But that's a little bit of a digression. What I really want to say is that, great, then manifest that, do that, be that collaborative person, understanding exactly what you're saying, which is the system is the system.
And so, if you want to continue to have the opportunity to be collaborative in the system, you actually do have to participate in the system to a greater or lesser degree.
Right. And but there, I don't think that has to...
There's no free lunch. You right. can't just unilaterally, individually dictate the terms of a larger system and expect to be rewarded within it.
Right. I think that's moving away from the idea of deciding what your core values are and then using those. If something speaks to your core values, you're more likely to do it. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. If you define writing a single authored article as not collaborative, mm-hmm. if I was coaching you, I would spend a long time talking with you about why have you decided that's the definition of a single authored article.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Because you can be collaborative mm-hmm. and still, I mean, I know collaborative scholars who are incredibly collaborative.
Right.
And they're some of the best advocates and allies and pushing people forward and up.
Right.
So I think we really have to look at where we start getting rigid about how to apply it.
I think that's great. I think that's a fantastic response to that.
Yeah. So next time it comes up, you can say.
I will.
Why? All right. So to recap, you want to be productive, build a productivity pyramid. Your pyramid starts with your body. It all starts there. That's where the source of the energy is. Next place is your emotional well-being. You've got to take care of your emotions and build a practice seeking positive emotions. Little side note here, I'm bracketing all of the struggles, bracketing all of the mental health stuff, how hard all of it is. I'm not denying that those things are true and difficult and painful. I'm not saying think happy thoughts and it'll all be okay. Not what I'm saying here. What I'm saying here is that we can add a little bit of juice if we can access things that are positive memories or positive feelings. That's what I'm saying. Third thing is cognitive capacity. Academics like to spend 99% of their time there. They burn it out, fry it out. Don't take a break. Don't wander away. Build actual rest into your cognitive work, walking away from your computer, petting your bunny, whatever it is. Take a break repeatedly to fill that tank back up. And all of them are capped off by being operating and being driven by and being motivated by your value system, which is your spiritual capacity.
Absolutely. All right. And before we sign off today, just a reminder that you can find us on the Himalaya app and access our premium community there, where we have lots of opportunities for work with us directly, AMAs, premium member-only podcast episodes, and all sorts of various different initiatives that we're doing on the premium community page for The Professor Is In on the Himalaya app. So be sure and download the app and look for us there.
And just as a last note, in the next week or so, in the premium community, we will be doing a members-only podcast on how to plan for 2020. Hope we see you there.
Bye.